Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Oh, Jack O'Hara. Boy, you asked me some interesting questions, my man.
It's a great question, Jack.
Jack, hey, it's Josh Radner.
Hey there, Jack O'Hara. It's Johnny Damon.
Jack, you had questions for me.
Jack O'Hara, absolutely.
This message is for Jack O'Hara. Jack, how are you?
Hey, Jack.
Jack, hey, what's going on, man? How you doing?
What's going on, Jack? Listen, man, you know, you asked me a couple questions.
Live and broadcasting around the world, you're listening to The O Show.
In the show and doing your thing. I mean, you've got some pretty big name guests. I've seen your stuff, so congratulations on your success.
Jack O'Hara.
Much nicer guy than Conan O'Brien, with much better interviewing skills.
Don't forget to share this episode on your social media. Now, let's get to it.
I'm so boned. I forgot to get my girl tickets for the show tomorrow, and now it's sold out. It's her freaking birthday.
Aw, dude. She's totally gonna break up with you.
She's definitely gonna break up with me.
Should've used TickPick.
Wait, what'd you say?
TickPick. Look.
Oh, whoa.
What? There are no hidden fees. What'd you guys think I said?
Oh, TickPick. I thought you said...
TickPick. No hidden fees. Download today.
So I don't want to take too much of your time here, though. And again, I thank you so much for, you know, coming on the show. I'm very inspired in a way for how, like, you have been able to do what you've wanted to do since day one. Because again, with Big Cat Rescue and everything that you've done, from having a passion to it to, again, pursuing it as a career, you know, you're dealing with the business aspects of it. There's a lot of, you know, positive things. There's a lot of negative things. And as time evolved, you stuck with it. I guess my first question for you is what kind of inspired you from day one to want to pursue everything that you've done? Because again, you've done it for the majority of your life, if not your entire life to this point. And I don't know, like, kids my age are like constantly juggling like 20 different things that they want to do. They're changing their mind every day about what they want to do with their lives. But you've been able to stick to the same passion that you've had, and you still have a strong hold on it today. And how have you just, again, like, how are you inspired by it? And how have you been able to keep that passion as time has evolved over time?
From the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I knew that I wanted to help cats. And I became aware of the fact that so many domestic cats were being killed in shelters due to overpopulation. And so I wanted to fix that and felt like I could fix that. I had no idea how hard that was going to be. But because I knew it was such a huge problem, I felt like I really need to earn as much money as I possibly could, because it was going to be a very expensive endeavor. And so from the time that I was that age, I was selling popcorn and Kool-Aid and washing people's houses, you know, their mobile homes and their cars and everything else, and trying to get everybody else in the neighborhood working for me doing those things, because I felt like it was going to be such an expensive and difficult endeavor. And then it turned out when I was 30, well, in when I was 17, I came across bobcats that had been hit by cars. So I would be at the vet's office with a domestic cat, and they would tell me about this bobcat that just came in, and they can fix those cats up in 30 minutes to an hour. But then there's months of rehab for that animal to have to be in a small space to let the wounds heal, and then to be able to hunt and then release them back to the wild. And so I took that on when I was 17. And I felt like that was something I could do on the side and help. That was something that didn't happen that often. And then when I was 30, I ended up at an auction where I was buying llamas and using them for landscaping, because they clear about eye level. And so you could just turn them loose on a big tract of land and they would clear it, and then you'd move them to the next piece of property. And so I was there buying llamas, and the guy next to me started bidding on this 6-month-old bobcat. And I leaned over to him and I said, when that cat grows up, she is going to tear your face off, because bobcats are just like the most wicked animal on the planet. I just love them. They're so fierce. And he said, I'm a taxidermist. I'm just going to club her in the head in the parking lot and turn her into a den decoration. And so I started crying, and my husband started bidding, and we brought her home, but she had been a pet and declawed, so she couldn't be released back to the wild. And unfortunately, what I've learned since then is no exotic cat who's born in a cage can be released to the wild. You can only release the ones who are actually born in the wild, like the bobcats that have been hit by cars. So a year later, we're trying to find her some mate that she wouldn't tear up. I mean, she was killing our German Shepherd. She was attacking my child and my husband. And so this guy said he'd sell us a kitten to raise up with her, but we'd have to come there in person. And so this was in 1993. And it turned out to be a fur farm, and there were 56 bobcats and lynx. And so I naively thought, well, we'll just buy them all and we'll put them in pet homes. And we did that. And then about a year and a half, 2 years later, people would say, I can't deal with this cat anymore. And they'd be bringing them back to us. Meanwhile, other people started calling and saying, hey, I hear you have big cats. I've got a lion. Would you come get my lion? I can't play with it anymore. I've got a tiger. And I'm thinking, what are these people doing with these wild animals? And so again, I thought, well, how hard of a problem could that be to fix? I'll fix that, and then I'll get back to my main mission, which is domestic cats. So here I am 30 years later, still trying to fix the big cat problem, with my ultimate goal being to fix the little cat problem.
Oh my God. I mean, that's insane. Like you said, like some people are very naive in the sense of like, oh, this is going to be so cool at first. And then like 6 months in, when they gain a gajillion pounds and they're monsters in your home, like, what are you going to do with that? Like there's a sense of urgency at the beginning to say like, yeah, this is going to be a cool experience. But at the same time, once you get there, like you literally have no choice but to either give them back or again, do something about it. Why do you think it is that, you know, those animals that weren't born into the wild can't be, you know, taken back, like you were saying before?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. And one is one that we actually learned in the 90s. So we had been working with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, AZA. They're the ones that accredit the big zoos. Yeah. And they said that what they wanted to do was to reintroduce ocelots to Texas. And so we thought, well, that's great. We have ocelots here at the sanctuary. We have a really peaceful location where breeding them would be quite easy. And then the purpose would be to breed these cats, put them into a soft release program in Texas, and then those cats, kittens, would then be fully free, and they'd be raised by their wild parent to be released back to the wild. And so we never did actually produce any cats for the program, but I was involved in the program and saw what was happening. And what happened was they released all of these ocelots into Texas, and immediately they were wiped out by the rattlesnake population there. And the reason for it is that cats have, they have instincts that are regional to where they came from in their genetics. And so all of the cats, all of the ocelots that were in these zoos had come from Central and South America, where their primary diet are non-venomous snakes. So as soon as you turn those cats loose in an environment where all the snakes are venomous, they don't know the difference. And that was what wiped them out. And so that was the first lesson the whole planet had for, you can't do this even with a tiny little 20-pound cat, because they have these regional instincts. And all of the cats who are in private hands, like all of the people you saw in Tiger King, are considered private owners. I would be considered a private owner. All of these cats have no pedigree that traces back to the wild where they actually came from. So that's why breeding them is absolutely serves no conservation value, because you could never use it for any kind of reintroduction program. But as far as why it's illegal to do it is kind of along the same lines, in that these animals, they weren't born there. So if I take a bobcat who was born, like Winsong was born in Minnesota, I think, and I release her in Florida, that would be a violation of Florida law, because she's a non-native species. And the Minnesota bobcats are so huge compared to Florida bobcats, the reason you wouldn't want to do that is because you would create a subspecies or a mixed species that would have a huge hunting advantage over the native species and end up wiping them out. And anytime humans get involved in the natural order of things, we mess things up. So that's why it's not legal to release any kind of wild animal who was born in captivity. And, well, I know wild cats, I couldn't tell you that about other animals, but none of the exotic cat species are legal to be released back to the wild.
How early on did you have to figure all of this stuff out? Because when it comes to the rules, the laws, the regulations, considering everything when it comes to, again, wildlife and like when it comes to property and everything, like, did you know, like right off the bat, like, okay, I got to study all of this stuff in order to have all my stuff together. So again, I can, you know, prove all of these points and take down these people who are, again, abusing animals, not, you know, again, using them for their proper use.
No, because I was born into an era where there wasn't an internet.
Very true.
When I was 30, we didn't have the internet. When we were rescuing all of these cats, the only people we could turn to for advice were the breeders and dealers. Because if I called the zoo, which I did, you know, I called the zoo initially when we came home with 56 bobcats and lynx. I called them up and I'm like, what do I feed these cats and how much space do they need? And they hung up on me because I was one of those stupid pet owners and I didn't know it. And so the only people who would talk to me were the people who were making money off of people like me by breeding and selling and pimping out cubs to be used for pay to play parties and stuff like that for photos. And so they were saying that these are rare and endangered species and we have to breed them for future generations and the zoos don't know what they're doing. It's too crowded, too busy, too chaotic there. The animals don't do well. And so for the first couple of years, we actually bred cats here at the sanctuary. So from like 92, 93, maybe until 96, 97, we bred cats a very short period of time. And we never bred lions or tigers, just the more rare cats. And what we discovered with that ocelot program and some of the other things that I learned along the way from getting books at the library, and I started going to all of the conferences for the AZA. And even though we weren't a zoo, I wanted to learn from all of the experts that they would have at these conferences. And that's where I learned that none of these cats in private homes could be traced back to the wild and could never serve any kind of conservation value. So that's why we stopped breeding. And we stopped all intentional breeding in 1997. We had a couple of cats who were born after that to parents that either were like so old, we thought there was absolutely no way that they would have kittens and they did. Or there was another situation where I had sent the male in to be neutered and my operations manager had said that the cat was neutered, but apparently the cat was not neutered. There were kittens after that in like 1999, but it was only, you know, a couple here and there that happened after 97 because we figured out that they just don't belong in cages and we're not helping any kind of conservation to be breeding them.
And I'm sure that kind of boosts your overall motivation to, again, save all of these, because again, like having that passion at a young age, not kind of realizing like the business aspects of everything and the law side of things, I feel like there probably were a few things that you went through when, you know, going through all of this stuff, again, on the business side that you kind of were turned off by, in a sense, when it came to your passion of, you know, rescuing these cats.
Yeah, it was really difficult to apply business ideas and practices mm-hmm. to a nonprofit. And I think that's where a lot of nonprofits fail. They rely on people donating and caring about their cause to continue whatever it is that they're doing, but they're not often very good business people. And I had been investing in real estate for years. And so I already understood the value of earning a dollar. And understood how difficult it was and how important it was to always have enough resources. When I purchase real estate, I don't buy real estate unless I can pay cash for it. I don't borrow money because things can go wrong and then you've got a problem. And if I have it at our peak, we had 200 cats depending on us. Right now we have 52. But at our peak, we had 200 cats that have to be fed every day. And I can't screw up. I can't not provide enough money. There's nowhere for those cats to go. So we had to embrace every kind of thing that we could think of. You know, we did tours and we did sleepovers where people would spend the night. And we did summer camps for children and we would go out to events and we just did all manner of things trying to raise money. But we also had to weigh that against what kind of life is that for the cat. And so like with the tourism, our local zoo has over 1 million visitors a year. We kept our visitors under 27,000 people a year because we didn't want to be like a zoo where there was always people wandering around. And so we made it guided tours where people for an hour and a half, even though the public wants to be just taking their pictures of the cats, we're pounding into their heads all of the reasons why these cats don't belong in cages. And then at the end of the tour, we would actually take them into our gift shop and ask them to call their member of Congress to support our federal bill that would ban the cub petting, which is what causes most of the abuse and phases out the private possession. Because we don't want to be here. We don't think there should be places like us who have to rescue animals from horrid situations. We just shouldn't have horrid situations.
I again, like watching that documentary, it was like very weird to see again, like from your guys' perspective, everything that I saw was just like, okay, they're doing it the right way. Again, like you said, like after the tours, you're explaining what you guys do and what you guys want to accomplish, which I think is inspiring and great. And then you look at, you know, the Joe Exotics and the Doc Antles. And yes, I think obviously the media and the documentary is going to make out everybody in the documentary to seem a little off, a little crazy in that sense. But of course, on their end, like it turns out they're not only abusing their animals, but like just an overall bad environment. You know, the people that they're surrounding themselves with, the situations that they're getting in on the business side as well, I thought was very strange. And on your guys' end, you didn't even like realize what, you know, they were filming when they were filming it originally, right? When it came to producing that whole documentary.
No, we didn't, because when they came to us, they said the name of it was going to be called Stolen Wildlife, and that this was going to be the Blackfish for big cats. Did you see Blackfish?
I did, actually, yeah.
So the end result of Blackfish was there were so many people who didn't know how horrible it is that they were ripping these orcas away from their families and keeping them in these tiny concrete pools and then making them perform, and how they would die so frequently because they were so miserable in captivity and you just can't give them enough space, and all of the reasons that they showed in Blackfish for why we should not have orcas and dolphins and all of these amazing intelligent creatures in concrete pools. And it caused a change. SeaWorld said this is the last generation of orcas they're going to have in their facilities, and they stopped their shows right away. And so that was the show we thought we were working on. And when everybody else was seeing the same thing we saw in 2020, the teasers coming out for Tiger King, the producers of the show we thought we were working on had told us, you know, when they would ask me questions about Joe, I'd be like, why are you asking questions about him? And they said, well, you know, he's one of the guys that's breeding these animals and he says all this nasty stuff about you, so we just want to give you a part of it. And they promised he would be like 5 minutes of this show and the show would be all about the issues and what people could do. And so when the trailer started coming out for Tiger King, we called them up. We were like, who's working on that show? Because usually anybody who's working on any kind of big cat show comes to us. They need footage. They need quotes. So it was like, we don't even know who that would be, who would be doing a show like that. And then they didn't want to talk to us anymore. And so we sat down and binge watched it just like everybody else did and discovered that it was them. And we could not believe that that was the end result of 5 years of giving them all the information they needed to create a Blackfish, a really important film. And this freak show is what they came up with instead. So that was really disappointing.
I mean, and that's very manipulative, kind of in a sense. And like, I guess that's what they say about Hollywood too. I mean, that's at least what I've grown up being told about. You know, it's weird how they literally, like, you didn't have any sort of say in how that was going to go. Like, even after they made it, like, I figured that you'd have to have, like, some sort of consent from the people that were involved in order to create it that way.
I mean, they did get consent forms, and the consent forms was they could use whatever they filmed, but yeah, they didn't give us any control over what their end product was, and sure didn't give us any clue as to what that thing was going to turn out to be, because that was nothing like what we were pitched was the actual show.
What exactly were you and your husband thinking when you sat down and watched that for the first time? Because again, like, it probably was the most watched documentary in 2020, because it came out literally when the whole world went, you know, nuts with the pandemic and everything.
Yeah, I think that created a perfect storm. And here's what I've had a lot of time to think about this. And it seemed to have come at a time, of course, when everybody had just gone into lockdown. Everybody was scared. We didn't know what was going to happen with our jobs or with our families. Were we all going to die from this thing? And everybody was looking for somebody to blame for the fact that we were all stuck in this situation. And here comes Joe Exotic saying, everything in the world, it's Carol Baskin's fault. It's effing Carol Baskin's fault. And I think that's why that whole thing with the memes and everything took off. Even though people didn't, you know, consciously think that I was responsible for COVID, I think there was this need to find somebody that everybody could hate on at one time, and that I became that poster child for that based on the way that I'd been portrayed in Tiger King. So I think it was kind of perfect setup for that. But as far as watching it, I mean, we binge watched it because did you there was a podcast that Robert Moore did in August of 2019. So Tiger King came out like 6 or 8 months later.
Oh, it was like the Wonder something, right?
Wondery, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And so the way his podcast went, and it was about the same thing. It was like 7 or 8 episodes. And it starts out the same way Tiger King did, where you're meeting all of these crazy people. And he painted it as this feud, which is bizarre because I've never even spoken to Joe Exotic, but he painted it as a feud. And then at the very end, he said, but you know what? I found out that I was being lied to. And here's the truth about all these people that are breeding and exploiting these animals. And here's the truth about Carol. She has this beautiful sanctuary. And, you know, all, he came clean at the end of it. And he said the reason that he wanted people to kind of go down that path with him, the way that he showed it, was because that was the way he was led into it. He believed all of these people, the Cantles and the Tabros and the Joe Exotics, he believed them. And then he found out they were lying to him. And so he wanted the public to see that same kind of trajectory. So we sat through Tiger King thinking, okay, they're going to follow that same thing. You know, they're just copying Wondery. And they never got to the point where they said, but all these people were liars and none of these animals serve any conservation. They didn't get to any of that. Instead, they left it hanging on, you know, well, this is just all horrible and nothing's ever going to change for the animals. And then it was the end. And then they said, well, we're going to do this like 8th episode or 7th episode. So we sat through that and that was just awful, that thing they did where they were like talking to people from Tiger King, but it didn't answer any of the questions that were raised in Tiger King. So even when they had the opportunity to fix the problem, they still didn't do it.
That was my biggest takeaway after finishing that. Like at the end, it was more about, you know, this feud between Carol Baskin and Joe Exotic. And it was not about the animals at the end, which, and even a few of the people that were interviewed on his side were like, this has gone far enough when it comes to being about two people that it shouldn't even be about. It should be about the animals that, again, are either losing their lives or being abused or are currently in the wrong situation that they shouldn't be in, which I thought was very, and again, like, from the media side, that's what makes good TV, especially in a time where everybody is stuck in their homes doing absolutely nothing. They need something to, again, binge watch and look at and analyze and see, like, okay, like, oh, I saw this. I know exactly what's going on now. Like, I feel like a lot of people jump to the conclusions just like, oh, my God, like Joe Exotic, Carol Baskin, Doc Antle, what they're doing, whatever. And like in your case, again, like, because you had to, again, go through this stuff with the media back then. Now it's a different time, you know, 2020. As soon as this gets out, it's the biggest documentary that there is at the time. And people are probably coming at you left and right, social media, media interviews, all of this stuff, you know, kind of reopening that door, whether it was stuff regarding Big Cat Rescue or controversies or all of this stuff. Do you think that this, you know, it obviously gave you guys publicity, but at the same time, like you said, with the documentary, there were a lot of negative aspects to it.
You know, even though the, you know, overall, it was just, I feel like such a betrayal, the way that I was portrayed and the things that they did to us. I really feel like it turned out exactly as it needed to, because I believe everything, no matter how horrible, including COVID,
right.
Everything is happening for a reason, and it's all really for the good, and we need to find what that good is in it, and so that we learn and grow from it. And so I think the good that came out of Tiger King being so popular, one was, you're right, I mean, when my husband disappeared in 1997, that was a very different time than it is from now. And so having people look at it with fresh eyes and going over the evidence again and all of that, I think has been very helpful. And maybe we will find out something that we weren't able to find out then. Maybe something has changed in somebody's life since then that they were willing to talk now that wasn't willing to back then. So I think those are all positive things. And I think the platform that I have been given by the media, by virtue of the fact that everybody wants to rehash Tiger King, they have at least given me the opportunity to try and bring it back to the animals and to say, you know, that was a dumpster fire and I'm glad you enjoyed it, but here's what's important. We're going to lose the tiger in the wild if we don't do something like right now. And the very first thing we have to do is stop the cub petting, because that is what's driving all of the breeding, discarding, and that's growing the market for their parts and for their derivatives that are putting pressure on the wild population. So that's why we have to stop it right now. And so I don't think I ever would have had that level of exposure to the media had it not been for being portrayed as some villainous, money-grubbing, tiger-loving, husband-killing bitch.
Right. I mean, even, I mean, me personally, watching that about halfway through, I'm like, Carol and Howard are the only ones that are level-headed in all this so far. Again, like, I'm like, they're definitely going to come out of this, like, you know, Joe Exotic's definitely, I definitely see why he's in prison, like, let alone for, you know, the stuff at the beginning when you're kind of just like, okay, cub petting, abuse, and then towards the end, like, taking out a hit to potentially murder you. I'm like, this is, like, it's obvious that, you know, Carol and Howard are the level-headed ones in this situation. And you're right, like, you, maybe in a sense that you wouldn't have had the same publicity given the times that, again, like, you need to accomplish these things. These things are, like, far overdue from, you know, needing to take place for these animals. But at the same time, I feel like beforehand, before the documentary and everything, you guys were pretty, you know, social media savvy when it came to, you know, like, YouTube views and, you know, again, like, setting up that business side. Like, how in tune were you at the beginning when it came to starting your brand as an entrepreneur and all of this with Big Cat Rescue, in the sense of, you know, setting up those social media platforms and getting and generating all of those views for people to look at your stuff?
I think that I saw the future being in video. And back when the sanctuary could only afford to have 3 people on staff, I didn't take a paycheck for the first 11 years at the sanctuary. But when I could afford to pay 3 people, I paid somebody to manage volunteers, and that person makes sure that all of the cats get fed every day, that their cages get cleaned, that the water bowls get scrubbed, and that the tours were given. That manager is managing anywhere from 80 to 110 volunteers who are doing all that work for free. So that way, even once COVID hit, like, I had to lay off half of my staff, but my staff are only administrative. Nobody, I don't pay anybody to do any animal care. So that meant our animal care didn't have to suffer at all, even when we lost a third of our income due to not having people come to the sanctuary for tours. And so I felt like that was a really important person to have as a manager of those volunteers. I felt like having a gift shop manager was an important thing to have, because you need to sell the t-shirts and the branding and all of that kind of stuff, and get those t-shirts and hats and logos and bumper stickers and pins and all of that kind of stuff on every visitor we possibly could, so that they're out there advocating for our brand. And then the third person that I hired was a videographer, because I wanted every aspect of these animals' lives to matter. And I didn't want people to miss a single moment of from the time they got rescued to their rehabilitation here and everything they went through to get back to some sense of dignity. And by videotaping that stuff constantly and putting it out on YouTube constantly, that's how we were able to build the numbers that we have on social media. And of course, Facebook was just, you know, very much like YouTube. It was very visual, you know, pictures and videos were so important. We have probably over 100 volunteers who work just on our social media sites on YouTube and Facebook and Instagram, answering questions. We make sure that we have, like, layers of people who are, you know, there's 2 managers at the top, and then they're training all of these people that are their captains underneath to make sure they have all of the right information. And then those people are managing the next tier down, who are going into all of these chat rooms and into the chats on our own pages and talking about the issues and why these cats don't belong in cages and why the white tigers are all inbred and why the circuses shouldn't exist and all of those kinds of things, where you need that one-on-one. But we couldn't do that. We could never hire enough people to do that. But by engaging people and giving them a way of making a difference with their life and their time that they spend on social media, they'll tell you that, you know, this has been the most empowering thing they've ever done, and they do it for free. And so that kind of, anybody can run a business where you pay people, but I think a business that you run where everybody is working for free, that is a really hard business model to operate, and you have to give people something they can't get anywhere else. And for us, it's a sense of satisfaction and knowing that they've done something good. For other places, you know, it's because they get to pet a baby cub, you know, and that's a very selfish reason for people to do the things that they do. And it costs that animal, because they've been bred into this miserable life now, just so they could get those people to pay to be there or to clean cages for free.
I feel like people, you're going to find more people who want to do it for free to have the passion to want to do it too. Like, they're doing it for the animals. They're doing it because they want to, again, save that environment, save the certain aspects of the wildlife, and again, do it for the right reasons, as opposed to, like you said, like, anybody can run a business when you're paying people. Like, that's the number one motivation, is when you're paying people. But like, in your aspect, you're finding people who want to do this because they have a passion for it. And at the end of the day, they want to do what's right.
Yeah. And these are, you know, it's not like we're just taking every person off the street and letting them spend a day out here taking care of the cats. They have to go through 50 different classes as they progress through these different levels. And they have to work with the small cats here for 2 years before they can even be on the non-public side of the barricades. We never go in the cages and nobody's allowed to touch the cats here. But just to even be on the other side of the fence that takes the tour path, you know, separates the tour path from the cats, they have to be here for 2 years around little cats before they can ever be on that side with lions or tigers or leopards.
Wow. How often do you guys have to feed the cats per day?
You know, most places only feed maybe 3 to 5 days per week. And at when our cats were younger, we fed 6 days a week and fasted 1 day a week. And the reason that we would fast 1 day a week is because there are different medications the cats have to get, dewormers and flea treatments and stuff like that. And it's easier to get them to eat it if they've been fasted for a day. But now that our cats are so old, we don't fast. So our cats are fed every day. So we feed 7 days a week, but we're probably the only place in the world that does that. But we're probably the only place in the world that has a bunch of cats that are over the age of 20 too.
Oh yeah. Well, how often, like, what are the sample sizes when it comes to food and like the meats that you guys give them?
Because our cats are fed every day, they get smaller portions. So a bobcat might eat anywhere from 1.5 to 3 pounds. A tiger might eat anywhere from 8 pounds to 15 pounds a day.
Wow.
In the wild, a tiger could eat maybe 60 pounds at a single sitting, but they'd only eat like once a week or once every 10 days.
Wow. That's very fascinating. And again, like at a young age, like you were saying, given that 1 day to fast too, like I also feel like that's very important, like not only on the animal side, but also the human side too. It can be very frustrating getting through a day without food. But at the same time, like in their aspect, when it comes to, you know, like resetting things for them, I think that's very important. Do you, again, like from a young age, you knew that you wanted to do this and like getting to, again, grow, I guess, alongside these animals? Because again, like we're growing every day as they're going through, you know, their changes, whether it's physically, mentally, you know, spiritually. Do you feel like, you know, the animals, like when it comes to to certain cats, like, do you feel like some of them are very, you know, mild, reserved, but at the same time, like in a blink of an eye can like turn into like that raged animal that, you know, like we've seen, like have been able to, you know, bite people's arms off or stuff like that?
Yeah, we see that all the time with cats. And a perfect example, and we do this a lot on live videos for people, is we have a lioness here who's 20 years old. Her name's Nikita, and she's the biggest lioness I've ever seen in my freaking life. I mean, lion, male lion or female, she's the biggest cat I've ever seen. She's like practically chest high to me. And she's just this big, bumbling, friendly, happy, loves absolutely everybody cat. And you show her a piece of food and you would think she just wanted to kill everybody in her orbit because she was so focused on that food and didn't want anybody else touching it. And I mean, she just snarls and carries on like an absolute maniac. And so the way we have to feed our big cats is that we lock them out of those little feeding lockouts, those boxes that Tiger King showed my cats to live in. That's their feeding lockout. They live in huge enclosures. But we have to lock them out of that, put the food in, and then pull the rope and stand back to latch the rope away from the cat so that the cat doesn't feel like you're going to touch their food because they just get so angry over it. You can imagine if that cat hadn't eaten for like 3 or 4 days, how angry it would be. But thankfully here, they're eating every day and they still have that level of holy cats when they bust loose with that.
Oh, it's got to be intriguing. Like every time that you're again bringing someone in, like you have to gain that trust factor. Is that an almost everyday occurrence, or do you feel like as time progresses, like the cats know, like, okay, these people are taking care of me and everything's going to be all right?
It's interesting that you ask that, because what I have seen is, like, when we rescue a cat and bring it into the sanctuary, the time period it takes for them to be so distrustful to where they feel like they can trust us is so different per cat. Some cats, I mean, the minute they walk out, they're like, oh my God, I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy you're here. Thank you. There's food, there's water, there's shelter. And they're just so grateful. And then I've had cats, one bobcat, he had been left with his mate to starve to death in a cage. The owners just both moved away and left the cats behind. And they were on a concrete floor with chain link walls, and they were trying to dig their way out through the concrete. And so they had just worn their paws completely down to the bones by the time somebody found them. And we went in and rescued them. The female, within a few months, she was fine. And she was like, oh, this is a great place. These people are great. She'd purr and rub up against the fence. I took care of the male in that group. And for 5 years, I would spend time with him. I would talk to him. I'd read to him. I'd sing to him. I'd ignore him. I'd do, you know, everything trying to gain this cat's trust. It took 5 years before that cat finally, when I was out there cleaning his cage one day, just came up and just rubbed up against the fence like, all right, I'm okay now. And he was wonderful from that point on. But I don't see what you were asking about, which is, do they have that for each individual person? And I don't usually see that. They tend to be like, it's either great here or I'm not ready yet. And once they're ready, then they're fine with anybody.
So it's kind of, you know, an individual cat, like it's going to take them on their own time to kind of gain that simple trust. Like you said, 5 years, that must have been a good day.
I was bawling like a baby. I mean, the tears were streaming down my face. I was so thankful that he was finally at peace enough that he felt comfortable.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's got to be an amazing feeling in that sense. And yeah, like to what you were alluding to earlier with Joe Exotic going on the tour and taking pictures and, you know, like they're eating habits, like with those small cages, kind of, again, like on the media side, like spinning things and making things seem like they're way worse than, you know, they actually are, if not even not worse at all, you know. And again, that comes back to that media side of him, you know, not only like having a camera on everything, but again, like the documentary people that came to film, you know, spinning things, telling you one thing that they're going to say and having it be a completely different thing. Because again, you said that you and Joe Exotic, like you never even met, like you guys didn't have a relationship. Like why come after you so early on? Like, because obviously it was threatened at the beginning of the day when it came to his business side. But why do you think that whole, you know, quote unquote feud started between you two, even though there was no relationship there?
The first time he ever came up on my radar was in 2004. And when I say he came up on my radar, I didn't even know who he was. Yeah. But in 2004, a reporter had said, hey, there's this guy in Oklahoma that runs a sanctuary, and he has this lion cub who was just born deformed. What do you think about that? And I said, well, it can't be a sanctuary because sanctuaries don't breed cats. And that was the extent of my comment. And so I didn't even remember that article until Rob Moore's piece for Wondery came out in 2019. And he said, do you remember this article where you said this? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And he showed me the article and it was from 2004. I was like, oh my God, I had no idea that our history went back that far. Wow. Because I thought the first time I was aware of Joe was about 2009. And what I've always done since the internet came along is people would contact me and they'd say, you know, I went to this horrible little backyard zoo and I thought the animals were in awful situations and here's some of the pictures and what can I do? Should I contact the authorities? And so I would help people do that. And then there would be many people who would ask about the same places. And so I created a website and it was a competitor to Facebook at the time. I don't remember the name of the company because they're not around anymore. Facebook really did them in. But it was one of those things where you could set up kind of like, each person could set up a group. And so I had a group called 911 Animal Abuse. And people could post their pictures and their reports there, kind of like a TripAdvisor for backyard zoos. And when that thing died because of Facebook, I took all of the information from it and I put it on a website. And so each one of these little zoos had their own page that said, you know, here's what visitors actually saw when they went there. So that when people contact me and say, well, you know about this place, I'd say, go to their page and see. And I could just send them a link instead of having to type all that. So I had done that with all these different places that were exploiting big cats. And I realized one day that there were several places that they had different names in the newspaper articles, but it was the same people and they were wearing the same kind of clothes. Like, you know, Joe would run around in those black leather pants and cowboy hat and the chains around his waist and the handcuffs and all that kind of stuff. And that guy kept showing up at all of these different places on under all of these different names. And so there'd be like big banners saying it's the Awakening Zoo or it's the Wildlife in Need or it's, you know, all of these different names. But it was the same people and same cats and the same cages. It was just a different banner. So I put them all together that I figured out were the same one. And there was this guy that was operating with 21 different names. And that was Joe Schreibogel. And I was just like, I took it to my husband. I'm like, you're not going to believe this. This guy has figured out how to avoid being able to be attached to all of his citations that he would get for improper handling. I mean, he had something like 300 citations against him by USDA. But because he was using different names, people didn't know who to search or who to find out information about. And so I put it all on one page. And then my husband went in and he actually organized it because he's much more organized than I am. Yes. So that was about 2009, 2010. And that was when I first really became aware of Joe. And so that's why I was so shocked to hear that it actually went back to 2004. But I do that with all of the people that are abusing big cats and exploiting big cats. And so he wasn't any different from any of them. And that's why when I talked to the producers of Tiger King, when they would ask me questions about him, I'd, you know, say, well, you know, I don't want to talk about him personally. They would try every way that they could to try and get me to say something nasty or derogatory about him. And I just wouldn't do it. I mean, I don't, to this day, I don't say anything mean or nasty about him. I talk about the issues and about the exploitation and how it affects the animals. And so that was why I was so shocked that they would focus on this one person, because there were so many of these people, probably 30 of them at the time that they started filming, that were doing these pay-to-play schemes with cubs. Now there's only about 6 of them left. So we're really gaining on it. But that's not been because of Tiger King. That's been because of, even though our federal bill, we've been pushing for it since the 90s, there have been a number of state bills that have either banned or limited the private possession of big cats. And so as those have taken place, that's what's caused a lot of these places to change their model. And we weren't trying to put anybody out of business. We just felt like there's hundreds of zoos that don't have to do the cub petting to survive. And Joe could just adopt his model, his business model, to be like any other zoo, and he could run a zoo. In fact, when my husband and Joe had actually gone to mediation to see if we could work out an agreement on the $1 million that he owed us, and they worked at it for a long time. But what Howard and Joe came to was that Joe would make really modest payments to us, and we would adjust those based on the time of the year, because sometimes of the year he had more income than right. others. And he would just stop doing the cub handling and stop doing the breeding. And so we were thrilled that that's all we wanted, was for him to stop the things that were causing the most abuse. And then when it came time to sign the agreement, he kept putting us off and putting us off. And so finally, all the attorneys got onto a call and they were like, you know, what's going on? You guys agreed to this and he wasn't signing it. And I think that might have actually been in Tiger King, where Jeff Lowe had come in and told him, we're not going to do this deal. I'm going to pay your legal fees and we'll just keep fighting it. So it was unfortunate, because Joe could have kept his zoo and could have kept doing everything that, you know, he was doing with animals, even though I don't think it's a very nice life for the animals. And I've been to the zoo and seen how horrible the conditions are there for most of the cats. You didn't see in Tiger King that most of his cages are only about 16 feet by 10 feet for a 500 pound cat to live in. It's like keeping your cat in a taxi, a pet taxi. But you know, if he would have just stopped the breeding and adding to the problem, then that would have been good enough for us.
Wow. I mean, so that goes back almost 15 years without even, you know, you never met the guy in person, did you?
No, the first time I ever met him was actually in a deposition after, you know, we had to sue him because he was ruining our name. He was going around the country calling himself Big Cat Rescue Entertainment. And using our logo, you know, part of our logo and our font that we used on our cards. And then he had taken out a 813 area code, which is our area code, and called it his Tampa office. And then he went on Facebook and admitted to somebody else, we got the screen capture of it, that the reason he was doing it was to try and ruin our name whenever he was out there doing the cub petting. And it was working. People were calling me so angry and saying, here, you've been teaching us about why it's so evil to be breeding these cats for life in cages. And I saw you were out at the mall in the Midwest. And it was like, that wasn't us. What are you talking about? And so that was how we found out what he was doing and how we got the $1 million judgment against him. But at any point, he could have stopped that. So anyway, I saw him at a deposition for the hearing. And then, of course, he actually agreed to pay us the $1 million so that the lawsuit would stop. So it was what they call a consent judgment. It wasn't ordered by the court. He agreed to it. And then he went out and tried to file bankruptcy, thinking, well, I'll just agree to it and then I'll file bankruptcy and she won't collect anything. Well, I don't know why, but the bankruptcy court said, no, you're not doing that. You're going to pay her the money. And so I saw him at a bankruptcy hearing when my husband had open heart surgery and couldn't be there. And then the last two, I've only seen him four times. So the last two times were at the murder for hire trial. But at none of those did I ever speak to him.
Wow. And the first time I saw the Big Cat Rescue Entertainment, I immediately was just like, copyright infringement. Like, is anybody going to say anything about that? And then obviously he loses out basically everything and then tries to, again, like, file for bankruptcy. He's burning every last one of his assets, trying to get rid of everything. I just found all of that very, you know, kind of insecure on his part, in a sense, because again, like you are known for, again, wanting to save these animals. You're finding, you know, the guys like Joe Exotic and even now Doc Antle's out. You know, he's out of his commission, in a sense. Do you feel like this documentary, again, like there were a lot of negative aspects to it? It made a lot of people look bad, like you said. It was a dumpster fire, but at the same time, I feel like when it comes to, again, the act that you guys are trying to put through, like we've been trying to put through for the past 25 years, past 30 years. And at the same time, like, I feel like now that those two, again, like head honchos, when it comes to the entertainment side, treating animals so poorly, they're, you know, out of commission. Do you feel like things have slowly gotten better, even though there's still a lot more to be left accomplished after this?
I do. And I got to give credit to Tiger King for raising the awareness. Yeah. One of the things that I found difficult whenever I would go in to talk to a legislator or to their aide is I would say, there's these people that are breeding 200 tigers, no count even on how many lions or ligers, but 200 tigers a year, at least, we're able to identify through matching up their stripes and such on social media. They're breeding 200 tiger cubs every year to use them for about a 1 month window that they can do the photo ops with them, because after they reach like 12 to 16 weeks, they can take a finger off a child. Yeah. And so after that, they're disappearing into backyards or into the illegal trade for their parts, or just up and disappearing. And some say that they're actually being cremated on site at these places when they can't use them anymore. And so I would go into a legislator's office and say that, and they were like, you're out of your mind. That can't be legal. We've surely got some law against that. You can't be doing that with tigers. Tigers are endangered species. And we're like, but it's happening. We need to do something. And they just didn't believe it was a problem until they saw it on Tiger King. And now they know it really is a thing. It really happens all the time here in the U.S. And so I think that that has given our bill a lot more momentum than we ever had before. The fact that we just passed the House with a 2/3 vote is monumental. And unfortunately, that was on December the 3rd, so it was right at the end of the session. But we reintroduced right away, and we have in this session already 126 co-sponsors. And so we really believe it's going to pass this year, because people know it's a problem and they are willing to sign up for it and say, we're not going to allow this to happen in our country. And what the bill does is it makes it illegal to do the cub petting, and it phases out private ownership. So people who have the animals can keep them. They just can't buy or breed more unless they have a USDA license. So somebody like Joe or Jeff Lowe or Antle, they could continue to be in business because they have USDA licenses, but they can't do the cub petting, which is what causes all of those animals to be bred and discarded.
Do you find it kind of frustrating, or kind of, you know, kind of a breakthrough in a sense of like you going in and explaining everything that's happening and then like giving them evidence and being like, oh my God, this is awful. Like, how are we not, you know, putting a stop to this? Like, nobody really, at least in like the mainstream level, took it, you know, to the number one priority until they saw the documentary. Like, do you find that more frustrating or groundbreaking?
Yeah, well, it's kind of some of both. It was frustrating in the past, and now it's groundbreaking that people are actually getting it and things are changing. So again, even though, you know, my family and I think I personally paid a pretty high price for Tiger King and the way it came out, the end benefit is that the world is going to be a better place because we're going to get rid of the cub handling, and that means we'll be able to save the tiger in the wild. And I don't think anybody on the planet could imagine a world where we didn't have lions and tigers living free. And yet that's what's going to happen in the next 5 years or so if we don't stop the cub handling because of the pressures that it's putting on those wild populations. It's not because those cubs come from the wild. It's because it's expanding the market for their parts. And if you expand that market, people are always going to want the premium product. And that's always going to be the wild tiger. And it's always going to be cheaper to shoot a tiger than it is to raise it to be an adult, because it takes 3 to 5 years for a tiger to become an adult, you know, full size. And it costs $10,000 per year per tiger just for food and vet care. That's not any of the overhead of the sanctuary. So it's a whole lot cheaper to kill a wild tiger than it is to farm them for their parts. And that's why we have to stop it right now.
And I'm sure once the whole COVID stuff broke too, there was a ton of concern, like not only just nationwide, nobody really knew what was going to happen. Nobody really knew how serious this was. Was there just going to be millions of people that were going to drop dead? And unfortunately there were thousands. But in your case, like you said, when it comes to, you know, when it comes to food and beverage, that's 10 grand a year for these cats. Like, did you feel, again, like your back was against the wall in that sense when everything was going down? Or did you feel like, okay, like we can manage throughout the next year if this thing prolongs another year?
Fortunately, when I met my current husband, Howard Baskin, I met him in 2002, I think, and he started working for the sanctuary in 2003. And it was funny because for the first 11 years of the sanctuary, it could not break even. And so it was my real estate business that carried it through all those years. And the year 2003 was the first year that it ever broke even. And so it happened to be the first year that Howie was here that we broke even for the first time. And he said, you know, we need to, because he came from Citibank and he had been in charge of a multi-billion dollar division of real estate funding for banks and for buildings and commercial real estate. And so he said, the first thing we need to do is make sure that these cats we have now have a pension plan. And I'm like, oh, what? And he's like, well, you know, after 9/11, when 9/11 hit, were you around in 9/11? I mean, that was just tourism stopped. All of the donations to anything but 9/11 issues stopped. And I was doing things like selling my personal jewelry. I sold my car. I sold everything I had to make sure the cats got fed. And so I had already lived through 9/11 in 2001. And so in 2003, it was still fresh in my mind. And he said, we need to make sure if another 9/11 hits that we've got the money to take care of the cats that we have through the end of their lives. And it was like, well, where do you think that money's gonna come from? Because this is like the first time we've ever even broken even. Where are we gonna get the money? And he said, we need to take every dime we possibly can that comes in over what we absolutely have to have and put it into an endowment fund. And so we did that, and we struggled for years, but we built up the endowment fund so that if anything did happen, if there was another 9/11 or if there was another pandemic, that there will be enough money to provide the food and the vet care for every cat we have through the end of their expected lifespan. And that number right now is right about, at the time that we started doing this, that number was over $5 million that we had to put aside. Now, because our cats have gotten older and so, you know, a lot of them have died because those were huge fur farm rescues that we did in 92, 93, and 94, where we rescued 56 cats at one time and 28 and at another time and 22. But those cats now have passed because they're all in their 20s. There's still one. It's still alive. She's 24, 25 years old. Wow. Yeah. But anyway, that number that we have to have set aside in reserves is like $2 million right now. And we have that. So even if we were to hit another pandemic, the cats that we have would never go hungry. I'd have to lay off all of the rest of my staff. I wouldn't be able to take a salary, but I would have enough money in the bank to actually feed and provide vet care for them until they died. No other sanctuary in the world has an endowment fund that would take care of their animals through their animals' life expectancy. But we felt like, again, this is a really important business decision to make for these animals because there's nowhere for them to go. And we had to be sure that they would have a safe passage.
And in those specific situations too, whether it's COVID or anything that you've dealt with, you know, battling some adversity when it came to the business or even in your own personal life, like I feel like when you are going through that kind of stuff and having to make big decisions in a quick form, that's almost like you look back at those and think like, okay, that's what molded me. That's what made me into, again, the entrepreneur, the mindset that I'm going into this, the things that I want to get done when it comes to either the animals or whether it's, you know, my husband, my daughter, my family, all of that stuff. Do you feel like looking back at everything that you've done in that aspect, do you look back at the moments where you've had to battle the adversity, whether it was back then with personal stuff, whether it was with the business, with the animals, you know, taking on Joe Exotic and people with cub petting or abusing these animals? Do you look back at those and think like, okay, like they were tough times, but at the same time, it's what lit the fire under me to want to accomplish these things and go out of my way to accomplish these things?
One of the things I've always done is kept a diary. And I've just in this year, well, the beginning of 2020, started releasing a day from my diary every day on my YouTube, my personal YouTube channel. And it's been so interesting to record those pages from my diary, because as I'm going through them and I'm reading them, I'm thinking, how did we survive this? Oh my gosh, things were so hard and they were so desperate and we were struggling so hard with so many different things going on. And I will often, after I do a recording on one of those, I'll call my mother or I'll go into my daughter's office and I'll be like, do you remember when? And they'd be like, oh man, those were the days. Those were some really hard days. So it's been kind of interesting to relive those because you forget how difficult sometimes things were because at the time you just had to do it.
Do you like when you were reading those, you are immediately like taken back in time, like, oh my God, like I remember exactly how I felt. I knew where I was when this happened.
So many times that's the case. And yet other times I read things and I'm like, I don't remember this at all. So I'm glad I wrote it down.
That's hilarious. And then of course, with the documentary, like all of those memories coming back, I feel like, and again, in a negative aspect, but at the same time, like we've been talking about, there were the negative aspects. And then there's the aspects where they did promote what's currently happening with these animals. And in the long run, you got to think that it's all going to be more so positive than negative when it comes to accomplishing what you want to accomplish.
I do believe that.
Yeah. And the last thing I want to, again, talk to you about, I don't want to take too much of your time, like almost an hour here. I can't believe I've already taken an hour, but an important thing I like to talk about, you know, again, with all of my guests is, you know, having that, again, I don't think there's a certain life balance, but I do think that there's a way to, again, be the entrepreneur and at the same time, be a mother, be a family member, be, again, a wife. How do you currently balance all of that? Because again, like when it comes to your husband, your daughter, you guys are all, you know, in this, you all have a passion for it. You're all trying to accomplish the same goal here. But at the same time, do you guys have anything else that you enjoy doing as a family, whether it's, you know, you and your daughter, you and your husband doing stuff, taking time away from the animals, or is it 100% this is what you're doing all the time?
I have no work-life balance. I never have. And I think that is a detriment. I really think there's a huge missed opportunity in balancing your life, because so many people say at the end of your life, when you're laying on your deathbed, the only thing that matters is family. Mm-hmm. And I have really sacrificed that relationship with my daughter, with my parents, with my brother, with everybody in my life, because I've been so single focused on ending this problem that I expect someday I'll look back and think, God, I wish I'd spent more time with them.
Wow. Well, that's definitely an inspiring thing. Because again, like when you look back at it, when again, those moments of battling adversity, when you're kind of like your back's against the wall, like you think about the most important things in your life. And I'm sure you think, again, of your husband, your daughter, as well as all the cats that you're, again, trying to save, trying to nurture when it comes to the sanctuary.
I think the benefit has been that all of them have had the same passion that I do.
Yeah.
And so when my back is up against the wall, so is theirs. When we've all got each other's back, we are all like back to back on this, attacking from every angle that we possibly can, because we all feel so committed to the cause. If that had not been the case, I don't know whether I could have succeeded as much as I've been able to, because I hear so many people who run other sanctuaries that they're like, you know, I could never have a relationship because I'm always working, taking care of the cats, and I have no time for a husband or for kids or for any of those things that they really want in their lives. And so I've been so fortunate to, I think Jamie and I have been around and around the eons together. Jamie's my daughter, and we take on these battles every time we come back into each other's lives. But I think Howie is new to me. It's I just never had that feeling of, oh, I knew you in a past life. It's like he's new, and yet here he was right there with everything the minute he stepped in. And so that's been wonderful.
Do you think hypothetically, because again, that is a great situation to be in, like when you guys are, you know, in the trenches together, you're all trying to accomplish the same goal. You guys all have the same passion. So you're able to come together as a collective unit and take it on. But do you think hypothetically, let's say your daughter wanted to be like a softball player or something and like had no interest in doing what you did, like what do you think you obviously would have sacrificed for your daughter? Like when it came to certain situations, you had to be somewhere where you at the same time you had to take care of the cats. Like what would have gone through your mind in that sense, hypothetically?
You know, that's actually come up a number of times because she's artistic and she would love to spend her life doing photography and art. And she has her own business, the Dancing Butterfly Studio. And yeah, she does great at it. She has that side gig that she does on her own. She was telling me she just did her taxes and she had a great year. And those are things that she would really love to be doing. But I feel like she is helping me with this because she feels like this is something that we can accomplish in our lifetime, and then she can do the things that she wants to do. But she's made it very clear that she wants to be able to do those things that she wants to do while she's still young enough to do them. And she just turned 40 last year. So I always have that sense of like I'm pushing my needs on her, and I don't want her to feel like she has to be doing this. And so I'm always telling her, you know, I've got this. You don't have to worry. You can do what you want to do. But on the other hand, I'm so thankful that she has stayed here, because she's the one who runs the sanctuary day to day. She's the one that makes sure that we have safe policies and that our policies are fair to everybody. And that's not easy when you've got 110 people. Everybody has their own idea of what's fair. And so it takes a lot of work, and that's been something she's been willing to put into it, even though that's not her, you know, her passion is to save the animals, not to make people work well together, but you have to get people to work well together in order to save the animals.
I mean, at the end of the day, you guys are going to look back at this. It's going to be an entire family legacy that you guys have put out in trying to, again, accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. And again, I hope you accomplish the things, whether it comes to, you know, finally getting that act through legally or anything else you guys are trying to do. You guys are definitely going to look back and most likely like be proud of what you guys did. I'm sure you're proud of what you've already accomplished thus far, but again, trying to accomplish so much more. But again, Carol, I want to thank you so much for being gracious enough to talk to me for the past, again, hour here on this Monday. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and I wish you the best of luck with Big Cat Rescue and everything that you guys are doing, because I think it is very inspiring and very great what you guys are doing.
Thank you for the opportunity, Jack.
I'm so boned. I forgot to get my girl tickets for the show tomorrow, and now it's sold out. It's her freaking birthday.
Aw, dude, she's totally gonna break up with you.
She's definitely gonna break up with me.
Should have used Tick Pick.
Wait, what'd you say?
Tick Pick. Look.
Oh, whoa, dude.
What? There are no hidden fees. What'd you guys think I said?
Oh, Tick Pick. I thought you said
Tick Pick. No hidden fees. Download today.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.